It is Saturday, October 9th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and the second half, your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
So you're living in a world that you don't know nothing about. Sitting at your keyboard paralyzed with doubt. But just sit tight, we're here to help you out. We don't know it all, but we'll tell you what we found out. If it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio. We're friendly, helpful boys.
Well, that's quick and short. Sorry about that, Michael. Michael Saunders wrote that song for us and performed it for us. And, of course, you're welcome to join us by making your own music theme song for GeekSpeak, and we'd be happy to play it on air. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the air room with me are Miles Elam, and he's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Lindsay Lonnie, she's a systems analyst. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning.
Today on the program, we're going to be talking about news. And so let's go ahead and start off with, well, we always do it, Facebook news. Lindsay?
Yes, Facebook. So this Canadian guy was ordered to pay Facebook $1 billion in compensation. That's $1 billion. Basically, in May and March and April of 2008, he sent over 4,366,386 spam messages to Facebook users. Basically, he had an app that would point them to a website, and they would enter their login details thinking that they were going to get this great app. And he would use that to log in, pose as their friends, and post to other people's walls with, hey, look at this great link. And it would look like it was their friends posting this. So they would click on it, and it would get them, you know, to some Viagra page or something.
How much money did he make if he can get fined $1 billion?
Yeah, they said that he made a significant sum. But
so
they didn't say exactly how much. So he's paying $100 per spam message. But he says, good luck, Facebook, getting anything. He's filing for bankruptcy.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting stuff. The district court judge in San Jose was the first one to make the ruling. But then on September 28th, the Superior Court upheld that ruling. So, but he's Canadian. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
The spammers might run. All right. Well, thank you, Lindsay, for that.
Sure.
Appreciate that. Miles, morning.
Good morning.
So what's going on with tagging?
Well, right now, the law enforcement will tag offenders, usually felony offenders or repeat offenders, so that they can know where they are at all times.
We mean physical tagging, like put an ankle bracelet on?
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's a company that, you know, contracts for the government to provide these devices, mm-hmm. so that they can know where these people are at all times. Well, turns out for about 12 hours in 49 states, the tagging stopped working.
Uh-huh. And meaning that you couldn't find out where these people were.
Right.
Okay.
You had no idea where their whereabouts were.
Some system glitch.
Right.
Good.
Chaos.
And the reason for it, this was the general story, so the geeky aspect to it was that it was after the database had a little over 2 billion entries. Those of you who have a programming background, a little over 2 billion should sound conspicuous.
Yes.
Basically what it means is, and why there would be 2 billion, it's not there are 2 billion offenders.
No.
It's that every second or every short interval, you're getting a record as to where that person is.
All the logs of where
you say this person is at this position at this time.
Okay.
And at about a little over 2 billion, suddenly it stops working.
Okay,
like there's no failover.
So for those in the audience that don't understand the significance of a 2 billion or a little bit above 2 billion, why is it significant?
Most computers made before, 10 years ago.
Sure. 12, 15, somewhere now.
Had support for were 32-bit computers, did not have 64-bit extensions. In fact,
oh, that clears it all up, Miles.
No. Hold on.
Okay, go on. They had an ability to count that was kind of a basic structure of them, kind of like we have 10 fingers. Computers have a number system
as
well.
They count in binary instead of a base 10.
Right.
And the bits means the number of ones and zeros per number.
But isn't it pretty fair for me to call an analogy of, like, we're really good at 10s, computers can be really good at 32s?
No. Computers are really good at 2s. We're really good at 10s, computers are good at 2s.
I understand this, Miles, but I'm trying to explain to the average user without going into a full description of binary and bytes.
Well, I'll skip over that and just say a 32-bit number can either handle any number from 0 to 4 billion and change, or it can handle from negative 2 billion and change to positive 2 billion and change. So it splits up that difference.
And that would be called an integer on that system?
Yes.
Okay.
And when it goes from the negative to the positive, it's called a signed integer.
Right. So you can say it's negative or positive.
Right.
So what you're saying is when you hear that something crashed at a little bit above 2 billion, it sounds to you like you ran into that number. And also,
right. Someone created a database
anymore.
Where they weren't thinking about how many records were going in there and said, oh, this will be fine as a 32-bit value. And didn't change it up to be a 64-bit value, which would have been warranted in this case.
Right.
64-bit value not being twice as much, but rather 4 billion times larger.
Right, multiply that number by 4 billion. Pretty easy. Then they would have been fine.
Right. And so, which is probably what they did as a fix. It's probably how they fixed it. But
the other thing they could have fixed it is they could have reset the index on that table to negative 2 billion, and then they'd have another...
You don't necessarily want to change the primary key records on a database. It depends upon...
Not modify the counter, the index. But I see what you're saying. It's not exactly
going
safe.
To negative primary key indexes is probably a bad idea, too.
So it took 4 hours to figure this out and get it working again?
Took 12 hours.
12 hours. Someone got woke up from sleep.
Somebody got woken up from sleep and spent all night trying to figure out the problem and then
you'd think
making
that someone
fix.
Would wake up and go, wait, what's the database record? Oh, I know what happened.
No, quite often, especially since this has been operating for many years, that you don't think about it. Like, you set up your system and then one day it fails, you have no context as to why it failed.
Yeah, but Miles, you read the news story, heard it was 2 billion, and went, oh, I know what happened.
Right, because
there's got to be other people like you.
Right, because they went back and the person who was working on it went back and looked at it.
Oh, and saw there was 2 billion records.
Right.
Right, no one else knew that necessarily there was 2 billion records. Okay. Very cool.
People who actually saw the problem were the people who worked for the company. And
I was hoping that your geeky story was going to be geeky because I saw the, you know, tagging criminals. I'm like, that's not geeky.
So it clearly is.
You win.
Right, but this is down. What this comes across, though, is there's so many items, especially when there are, you know, some failure happens in a system where sometimes it's completely opaque to everyone involved. But every once in a while, you get this story where you get computer geeks, their ears perk up, the hair on the back of their neck stands up and go like, huh? Wait a second.
Ooh, that's not a signed integer. Or is a signed integer. All right, thank you so much.
Wait, they're getting paid how much for this system? I'm on the wrong line of business.
Morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, you're up.
You want to go and talk about ISPs?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Comcast in particular, and they're a big one, right?
Comcast, huge.
Yeah.
ISP, sure.
Nation's largest residential internet service provider.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now I do.
Now you do.
I feel
That's
more rich
why it's
as
news.
A person.
And knowing is half the battle.
Okay. Everyone played that in their head right after you
I
said that.
I tried, but I couldn't. Miles, can you play it in your head? Can you sing it? Knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe.
Guys, no, that's great.
That's how that's going to end. It wasn't a theme song, but, you know.
No, everyone already played it in their heads when they heard that anyway. Okay, so G.I. Joe. Anyway, basically Comcast announced last week that it's expanding an initiative to contact customers whose PCs appear to be infected with a malicious bot program. And they're rolling it out region by region. So far, they're saying that people really like it. There's some questions as to whether or not it's okay to do this. Right now, it's passive. So what they're doing is they've partnered with a company called Dambala, D-A-M-B-A-L-L-A. I'm not really sure how you say that, but they're a security intelligence company, and they have a database of known botnet command centers. And if there is a bunch of the system will flag that a customer's address is spamming, and then they'll notify them with first an email urging them to visit a Comcast security page, which also gives them an offer of free Norton to download. And then it will put a banner on the top of their websites, basically saying, warning, you know, you need to visit this security site. They were talking about actually blocking them from using the internet and putting up that web page. But right now it's just passive, and they're saying that it's going over pretty good.
Well, it seems to me it's a great feature, because I've got to say, when I have a Windows machine that's slowing down, my first question is there a virus on it? And of course, it's a big step to get a virus checker, make sure it's updated, check it, scan it, and then you have to have the faith that that worked. You know, maybe it didn't work. Maybe the virus definitions aren't up to date and the system's blocking you from updating it. So it's kind of an unknown. So to have a managing system that's looking at the traffic on your machine to determine whether your machine is playing nice in the world, I think it makes a lot of sense. I like that they made it passive. And the communication through email, not so good. The banner, I think, is probably a lot more effective.
Yeah.
Though, I'm assuming it's tagged with, this is Comcast, right?
Oh, yeah.
I hope. And then when you click on it, you actually go to a secure Comcast page that has a signed cert, so you know it's Comcast.
Would hope so.
I recall that, you know, lots of times, there used to be a lot of viruses that they gave like an alert message or a pop-up would come up on your Windows machine.
Right.
And then you'd click on that to go, oh my gosh, there's a problem. And then you're all of a sudden buying a product from somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's just a marketing campaign. So that's a little disturbing. But I like that it goes right to a Comcast page and they're giving their customers Norton, I guess, free for a while.
Yeah, up to 7 computers per customer Norton Security Suite.
I'd love to know how much traffic spam systems on Comcast's network cause. You know, their customers spamming, how much actual cost it is for them.
Yeah, that would be an interesting analysis.
Yeah, I'm sure that somebody went, hey, this is costing us money. Mm-hmm. Probably be easy to stop it.
Right.
Well, I say kudos to Comcast for doing it. Sounds like they're doing it the right way.
Yeah, we'll see if other ISPs follow, because it's a lot of extra overhead and work for the ISP to partner and set this up. And so they're saying that a lot of ISPs, even though it's a problem, they just kind of turn a blind eye because they don't want to pay for the service.
Right, they don't want to do the customer support to handle it. What's the conflict? What do people not like about it?
Just that if they don't realize or know that they're infected, they might feel like they're being invaded. Like, let's say you're just on your computer and suddenly you're getting this pop-up from somebody saying, hey, you know, go to this site.
It does sound marketing and creepy.
Right. And, you know, now you've got this banner all over everything. I don't know. Some people just feel like their privacy is being invaded, I guess.
Hmm. But, well, the question I would have is, are there going to be false positives? I think if you've got a machine that's infected with a virus and you're on Comcast's network, Comcast has a responsibility to either get you off their network or help you fix the problem. I mean, it's in some sense, that rogue computer is playing not nice. And I bet it's against policy, too, for Comcast, you know, customers to do that kind of spamming.
Yeah.
So even though they don't know it, it makes sense for me, you know, instead of Comcast to say, you know what, you guys, you don't get in traffic this month, instead to say, can you please fix this problem? I think it's a good way to do it. I'd love to argue with someone who disagrees strongly that says, no, Comcast shouldn't be doing this. I'd love to hear that argument and thrash it. So if you're on Comcast, and I guess it's not in this area probably, right? They're just doing a pilot program.
I don't think it's here yet.
If eventually you do see a banner on all your web pages that says Comcast is trying to help you, first off, make sure it's not a virus, and I don't know how to do that. I guess you click on it and find out if you get an HTTPS, and it's comcast.com or some derivative. I think that's a pretty good thing. Thank you very much, Lindsay, for that story. Appreciate it. What's NAD?
NAD stands for National Association of the Deaf, and they are an organization that has come out in favor of a recent law signed into law called the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act of 2010. What that entails is, give some background. Right now, deaf people have a hard time watching media. If they go to Hulu, for example, until recently.
No closed caption.
Right, no closed captioning, and you can't see what's going on. And in addition to that, even standard televisions nowadays will have problems with the broadcast, or the televisions themselves will have bad controls for turning on closed captioning.
Does this have to do with just the TV interface not being very good?
And the menu systems that set up in the firmware. But at any rate, this law that's been passed basically states that the 36 million deaf and hearing disabled people that are out on the internet will now have a legally binding guarantee that they'll be able to go to a site and have a remedy if they can't access that information.
To just be heard, you mean? To file the complaint? I mean, does it fit under the Americans with Disabilities Act where you can sue for lack of access?
Well, it's not the Americans with Disabilities Act because that was a different law. But yes, it's a very similar set of legislation. And it is in that same spirit of saying if we're going to make this information available and it is a public good, then it needs to be available for everyone.
Right. So Hulu's now doing that?
Hulu actually was ahead of the curve and did it before the legislation was passed. Good. But now this is going to apply to all general media sites, sites that basically are taking the place of television.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have some cable channel that has to have closed captioning as part of their programming, but then they post it up on the web, that same programming, but they don't have closed captioning on the web, then they're in violation.
Right.
And they would be brought into compliance.
I remember having one of my one of the first TVs I bought as like an adult, unquote. I remember it had tons of buttons on the remote. It was really kind of annoying. And one of them was the closed caption button. I at first was like, that's really irritating. There's a button for closed caption. How often am I going to use that? But that's exactly what's happened is the remotes have slowly, that feature has slowly been hidden in TVs. So now you get a TV and let's say you're deaf or a deaf friend is over and you're trying to turn it on and you're going to spend 15 minutes trying to get the friggin' thing to work. Even though it used to be just a button. So I guess that's a good – I mean it's a good
type of legislation. When you click on the menu button, it's like, wait, where is it in this really long –
Oh, yeah. It's a mess.
It's like trying to navigate Windows 3.1 on your
– It's not that bad.
on your TV. It's like this menu goes to this menu, goes to this menu,
right.
And
right.
Then you find your ad.
Yeah, all right. Thank you very much for the update on America. I guess the – what's the passage? The bill? What's it called?
The law is called 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibilities Act of 2010.
What else does it cover? Just accessibility?
Yeah,
sounds like a familiar title. Was there anything else besides the closed caption issue? Do you know if there's more in that bill? I think it's interesting that it's banning from equipment to internet sites as well, because that's not equipment based. That's actually website. So it's a very it's a large bill. I mean,
it's anything that can display video, which also includes things like smartphones, MP3 players, digital video recorders.
Hello, definitely. Huh. I wonder if you buy a Windows PC or a PC in general. And then you're using a flash player on a website, whose responsibility is for it to have closed caption? The PC can't do it if the closed caption is not part of the feed. You know, the other thing that's interesting about the story is that the people that really get affected by this aren't listening to Geekspeak because we don't have a closed caption feed of any sort.
Yeah, by the way, just in case anyone worries about this,
know.
Yeah, this does not affect if you are putting something up on YouTube. This is not about individuals. This is about something that is first broadcast on television and then distributed via the internet.
Oh, interesting. Okay, thank you.
In other words, mass media.
Right, right. Hmm. All right, let's talk a little bit about privacy. Lindsay?
Okay. So there's a new tool suite helping track privacy policies. The Internet Society announced that the Identity Management Policy Audit System is available this week, and it's basically a suite of tools designed to give Internet users a clearer understanding of online use policies of the websites that they visit.
Ah.
So it was created from a collaboration with the Internet Society, the University of Colorado, the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Woo-hoo. Great organization.
Yeah, and the Center for Democracy and Technology, which I hadn't heard of before.
So what does the tool set look like? How does it work?
Basically, it consists of a free open source Firefox plugin. Oh. And it checks against a library of archived terms of service agreements and privacy policies from a bunch of popular websites.
Oh, cool.
So basically, if a site changes the fine print of one of the policies, the plugin will notify you next time you visit the site that it's changed and tell you what's changed.
Does it also give some kind of summary? Because I never read those documents, right? And I don't really know what the rules are on most of the sites that I'm a part of. And I just act as a dumb, you know, lack of personal safety space. Does it kind of summarize some of the things? Like, I remember Miles and I used to arguing about where we want to park our domain, or have our domains be served, our registers, because we really wanted to have control over our domains. Like, I have Troxel.com, my whole name, right, is a domain. I don't want to lose that to some other company. So to make sure that you're at a company that treats the customers really well, you've got to know what the legalese of the document is. And it's, of course, it's hard to read if you're not a lawyer. So Miles and I both had, I think, a few times talked about that, maybe on GeekSpeak, and finally settled. But the only reason I really was able to do it is I found a site that reviewed registers and made critique on what their good policies and bad policies were. Hmm. Of course, I haven't looked at the registers I use to see if they've changed. So the Firefox plugin will be very cool. What's the Firefox plugin called?
It is called the Identity Management Policy Audit System.
Cool.
And I'll have a link up there.
And if you use Firefox, it'd be great. I'm sure they'll have a Chrome one soon as well.
Yeah, exactly. They were talking about how this would prevent things like last year when Facebook changed their policy so that they have the right to use your photos and other content. You know, then you go to your page and it would say, hey, this part has changed. And a lot of people would have been aware of that before they, you know, because it was, I don't think it even asked anybody to agree.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Lindsay, for the update.
Sure.
Miles, what's going on with China? Oh, you know, yeah, we've got time for that. Go ahead.
This one's a relatively short one, but it talks about China blocking access to a Nobel Peace Prize announcement. The reason why it was blocked was because it was a Chinese activist looking for civil rights. Liu Jiabao, which I'm sure I'm getting wrong. Sorry for the pronunciation. At any rate, the reason why I bring it up is because it's very easy for us to say, like, oh, yeah, China is blocking these items. But it brings into mind the stories that we've had a few weeks back or past couple of months about the internet kill switch that is being bandied around in U.S. circles and in the Western world, but mostly in the U.S. And the idea of, oh, yeah, if there's an emergency, we're going to cut it off. And it's like once you get into that mode of saying we're going to cut it off, then what is that firewall, if you will, between a good use and the use of we don't want our citizens knowing that the international community is taking note of the fact that we have human rights violations.
Okay.
And is celebrating someone who is fighting against what we want.
Okay, I guess I get what you're saying.
Okay, he's skeptical. That idea of if you have an internet kill switch, if you have that infrastructure to be able to block items selectively, then that means that you have that choice of saying whether you're going to... it becomes the goodwill of the actors involved.
So not whether anything is actually blocked or anything, but more about the power of being able to?
Right. If you're in China, assuming you even heard that this was happening, you could not watch it. You can't get that message out. You can't even have people discussing the issue because all you did was you blocked off the BBC for this, you know, 2-hour chunk of time. And you're like, done. Problem solved.
Right. All right.
Selective information.
Yeah. Which I think is probably more dangerous than saying just blocked because the Great Firewall of China just says, oh, it's not accessible. So it looks like, oh, the site's broken. And because the Chinese internet infrastructure is so sketchy, you're not quite sure whether
really
something
sure.
is broken or if it's actually being blocked.
Right.
And so this falls into that line.
Cool, I guess. Thank you.
Sorry for the downer.
No, it's all right. It's all right. I'll end it there. The rest of the day will just be sad music. Geeks Week on KSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Hey, thank you for contributing to KSP during the fall pledge drive. There was quite a few contributions. I really want to specifically thank Jim and Judy Warner for their contribution during the Geekspeak Hour last week. Your contributions meant we exceeded our $100,000 goal and returned to regular programming last night at 6 o'clock. But the end of the pledge drive doesn't mean you missed your chance. You can make a contribution still if you missed out anytime you want at kosp.org. And thanks again. Today, you're listening to Geekspeak for another half an hour at least. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the other room with me, I have Lindsay Lonnie and Miles Elam. In the other room, ready to answer the phones, Rick Philman, as he is every week, is waiting for you to call 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. We'll take any calls with questions and comments about technology, put them on air, and chat about them. Again, the phone number, 476-2800. But that's only if you're in the 831 area code. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had some kind of free way to call the station from anywhere in the United States and Canada?
Hey, isn't there an 800 number?
There is, and that must be toll-free. 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. Miles, you got a geek bit for us today?
Yes, I was going to put up on our site later today. So after the show, go up to geekspeak.org, and you will be able to see some wonderful images of by a scanning electron microscope of
very,
very
small,
small things. No, very big images of very small things. For example, a wood ant holding a microchip in its mandibles, just how Wait, close up
why,
that is.
Why is so that geeky. Doing that?
It was just sitting on the ground, you know. And, you know, taking a very close-up look at...
I love the breed that you have when you've got an electron microscope. Oh, look, an ant holding a microchip. Why does he have a microchip? Because that's what we have around here. No, is it eating it? Is it assembling a small robot? All right, anyway, so...
Dust at a... looking at just household dust, things that might be in it, like, for example, cat fur or pollen... Velcro, a very close-up look.
Oh, cool, cool.
A microchip.
If you're interested in any of these things, you're a geek.
No, this is actually something that it starts... Things like looking at cigarette paper. It looks like this dystopian, otherworldly, you know, crystalline structure.
And it kind of is. No, I'm just saying, if you want to go look at electron microscope images because they're cool and you want to know what they are and everything, that's geeky. I'm sorry. That's exploring the world, man.
True.
Okay.
And everyone wants to know what their eyebrows look like.
No, really, everyone wants to know what other people's eyebrows look like. Not
sure.
Your own. You don't want to see those mites.
This is what someone else's looks like.
Are there mites on them? Do you see
no,
them?
No,
okay.
No.
Those are the eyelashes that the mites live.
Thousands of them. No. So once the show's up and once we the end of the show, we'll be able to post that link and we'll have it up there. So please take a look.
Do they have the credits for the ant handler? who has to be the one doing that?
Ant handler or ant wrangler?
Ooh, man, I think it's a wrangler. Geeks Beyond KOSP is supported by UC Santa Cruz, welcoming this year's new and returning students as the campus celebrates 45 years of innovation, excellence, and public service. Today's students, tomorrow's leaders. This is UC Santa Cruz, online at ucse.edu. What were we just talking about? Mandibles and...
Ant handlers.
Oh, yeah. If you've got an opinion of whether it's an ant handler, an ant wrangler, or some other form of managing ants, please give us a call and let us know what your opinion is. 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. 1-800-655-5877. We're getting no calls right now. Isn't that strange? We normally get calls like up the wazoo.
Yeah, it was the ant mandible comment.
It is. Everyone right now is searching their eyelashes for creepy things. Well, while we wait for calls, let's go ahead and start doing some more news.
The Associated.
There's something. Good. Lindsay, please.
Speaking of ants, I don't know. Let's
insects?
Talk about bees. Let's talk about bees. So scientists and soldiers got together and solved the bee mystery. So since 2006, 20-40% of bee colonies in the U.S. suffered colony collapse. And, you know, of course, a lot of other countries were having the same problem. People have been studying it, and nobody's really come up with an answer as to what causes it.
I thought it was a mite.
That's one of the theories.
Ah,
one of the many
okay.
theories. And okay. then UC San
That's
Francisco...
That's strange, though, because bees don't have eyelashes. So... Gone. UC San Diego did what for the bees?
Sorry. UC San Francisco actually discovered a fungus that they thought might be contributing. And then there was a bunch of other theories that involved RNA viruses. Uh-huh. But what ended up happening is a few doctors got together and did some tests and found out it's a combination of things. And this isn't totally solid yet, but they're saying that all their studies seem pretty conclusive, pointing to a combination of a fungus and a DNA virus that's causing the colony collapse. And they don't know if one weakens the bees and then the other one delivers the final blow, or mm-hmm. if it's just that one enhances the effects of the other.
And I guess the mites are just a side effect, and as the colony gets weaker, the mites are able to get in there easier.
Kind yeah,
like
probably.
A bad immune system, you get a common cold easier.
Right, so both are necessary. One without the other doesn't. Mm-hmm. Doesn't affect them, yeah.
Interesting. So it's a complex system. Imagine that. so unsurprising.
It also appears to not be cell phones
or
pollution or chemtrails or...
or anything specific that we've been doing, but more environmental. Mm-hmm. So interesting. So what I guess that it is harder to find a complex system cause, right? Because you get the fungus and you're like, oh, all these bees that have problems have this fungus. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, but all these bees have the fungus with no problem. And so on and so on. So as soon as you start stacking them together, you find out that the issue is.
Exactly.
So it's did you say an RNA virus?
It's a DNA virus.
DNA virus.
And with all the research that's been going on, they wouldn't have been able to figure that out alone. But it just so happens that one of the doctors doing this study in Montana He's studying bees. That's his specialty. And he's been trying to figure this out for years. He did a TV show one time. And this other guy was watching the TV show, and his brother works in the military. And he ended up meeting the doctor at a conference and saving his business card. And then when his brother started working on this military software, he told his brother, hey, that might work for figuring out what's going on with the bees. And he hooked the two guys up.
Cool.
And that's how this happened.
What's the software do, the military software?
So it's a cutting-edge military software that's designed for identifying like biological warfare chemicals. It identifies proteins. So they ended up using this on these bees and doing a bunch of experiments and finding out that it was this DNA protein.
So what you're saying is the Yellow Jackets are actually at war with the bees, and we just found out.
Right.
Yellow Jackets are at war with everything. That's not saying anything.
Hate wasps. Well, we have four hives on the property. I live in Ben Lomond, and we've I wouldn't say they're collapse issues, because I think the queens actually left or were never substantialized, but it's definitely one of those things I'm always watching to see how the swarms are. I'm like, okay, they're doing okay.
I know quite a few people in the area that keep bees. I think that's neat.
All right, cool. Thank you very much. We do have some calls, or we did moments ago. I don't see them on the list. So I'm going to go ahead and take line one. Can one of you see on the system we're using who is on line one?
I don't know. I can't see.
So challenging. Hi, you're on Geek Speak. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Mystery caller.
Oh, let me try it again.
Hello.
There we go.
Hello. You're on Geek Speak. Who are you and where are you calling from?
This is Mary. I'm calling from Woodruff, Wisconsin.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling. Can you pick up your phone by chance and put it closer to your face?
I'm sorry, what?
Are you on a speakerphone?
I am on a speakerphone,
Could you pick up by chance? It's hard to hear you.
Oh, sure.
Thanks.
Can you hear me better now?
Beautifully. Mary from Wisconsin, what is your question?
Okay, my question is regarding watching movies on my PC using Hulu, Netflix, iTunes, etc. I've tried to use Hulu for this, and I have the problem with it pausing. So that's, you know, probably not an option. Is there anything that I can do about that?
When you mean it has a problem that it pauses all automatically, or you want to pause it?
It pauses automatically, so
it's a network problem.
It's almost impossible to watch. Yeah, so I figured is it because my internet speed is slow? Is that the issue?
Actually, it may not be. I'm seeing the same stutter effect on Hulu, and we'll have watched a Netflix movie and it's completely smooth, and then I go to Hulu and I get this. It's like every 15 or 20 seconds.
Definitely. Yep.
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 It's a Hulu problem.
Yep.
Okay, so it's probably
Hulu. First off, what's your connection type? What kind of connection do you have? Do you have cable, DSL, some kind of wireless?
DSL. Well, we have wireless.
You have wirelesses? You have wireless in your home, but DSL to your home?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, if you go to DSLreports.com, isn't that one of those? If you go to do a Google search on speed test, DSL speed test, you'll get to a Yeah, and then you'll get to his site.
I just did that.
Yeah. Did it tell you that you had a problem?
It gave me a speed of 700 something.
They normally kind of give you a rating and say whether it's okay or not to do certain things.
What speed did it come back with?
700 kilobits per second.
That is rather low.
Is that slow?
If it's 700 kilobits per second, I'm not sure what the rating is, then it is going to be problematic on watching stuff. Do you happen to have Netflix? We can test that. Or can you try playing a YouTube video? The YouTube videos are such low quality.
In general, streaming video, you want to have between a 1.5 megabit and a 3 megabit connection.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. With YouTube, what I do with those videos is I pause the thing.
And wait.
The video load.
Right.
You know, I go and do something and come back to it, and that's how I watch YouTube videos.
And the problem with Hulu is that they really don't want you doing that, and the big reason is that it only will cache up to the commercials, because the commercials are actually delivered real time. So they're doing a certain kind of, they can't really cache past the commercial. So that's one issue.
Oh, okay.
And I think that they have a shorter amount of cache time on your machine than other services. That's why I think it's actually happening. So probably it's network consistency. Now, it's very common for DSL network consistency problems to actually not be your phone system, but actually inside your house. Are you in an older home or a younger home? Should I say?
Built in the 80s.
Built in the 80s. Okay. And do you know where the phone system comes to your home and how far away the cabling is from there to where you plug in your router? These are the kind of things that could potentially cause problems in your home network, if you will. The other thing you can do is you can actually call your ISP who's probably your phone company, and ask them to test it, and you're not happy with your service and what they can do about it. And they will have some remedies, though you'll have to be very skeptical about what they tell you.
Okay. So now if I want to go with, we were talking about maybe getting a subscription to the Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be when you streaming a Netflix, is that going to have the same issue?
If you have a network problem, it's going to be the same kind of issue. What I would do with Netflix is find a friend that has Netflix and then ask them to come over for dinner and then set up and get the, try the site with their account and see how it works from your home before you go ahead and invest in the contract with them.
Oh, okay.
And I think they do have free trials.
They do have free trials for
sometimes,
Netflix.
Sometimes, yeah.
Perfect.
Oh, sure.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Yes, one more thing.
Okay, it's just one more question related. With iTunes, if I wanted to actually, buy a movie, that's a different thing, right?
I mean, if you buy a movie, that is different. It will download the whole thing on iTunes, and then you can
download
it.
And that's not an issue. Okay, great.
Yep. All right, thank you so much
for your help.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Mary from Woodruff, Wisconsin. Wonderful. I hope she used the 800 number. Al from Watsonville, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, this is Al from Watsonville. Hey, I love your show. My question is, I'm trying to get an idea of what the timeline is for the reality of the next generation browsers. I've been looking at IE9 beta, and all my computers have GPUs in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the demos are cool, but, I've noticed Chrome isn't up to speed yet, and I don't know what the timeline is for Firefox. So do you guys have any idea what those timelines are?
Not up to speed in what way? What type of thing are you trying to do that is not going fast enough?
Oh no! I don't take up to speed in terms of speed. I meant that if I go and download the latest, released Chrome browser, it doesn't support the digital GPU inside my PC for handling 2D and 3D graphics, whereas IE9 beta does support it.
There's a bit of marketing going on there. There is some truth in it, but just enough to make things look a lot better for an Explorer 9 than other browsers.
What we're talking about here is that Al in Watsonville has a graphics card that can do a lot of stuff on the graphics card. It's an additional card to his normal computer. It's a GPU, graphics unit processor. And the question is, are browsers taking advantage of that power and allowing images to render faster and everything to go a little faster? And specifically, 3D kind of imagery, OpenGL stuff. And there's not a lot of content online like this that goes in your browser. Miles, you know a bit about this, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Sounds like you do.
Yes. One of the things that Internet Explorer 9, which isn't out, by the way, until mid-2011, I believe, somewhere around May, I think was the target date. Someone correct me if they look it up.
Right.
But the idea behind that and their claim to fame is that using the canvas tag, they're able to draw 2D and 3D images to that canvas much faster and using basically what amounts to DirectX functionality in the background, accelerating the graphics. And so it goes faster in that one test than the other browsers. But at the same time, browsers such as Safari, Firefox, Chrome are all supporting a technology called WebGL, which is also doing 3D accelerated graphics based upon an OpenGL model. So they are all taking
Windows
advantage.
Windows really likes doing DirectX instead of OpenGL because they own it.
Well, it's apples and oranges. Accelerating the canvas is a noble goal.
It's apples and Windows.
It is a useful goal because that is going to be where a lot of animation goes on.
How is Windows IE9's JavaScript playback? Rendering, whatever you call it.
Their JavaScript engine is about as fast as Firefox, is maybe a little bit faster
so
for
Chrome,
IE9.
So Chrome's still beating it?
Chrome still beats the pants off of everyone else. And there's a debate about how much that matters, considering once you get past a certain point, the JavaScript engine is not your limiting factor, how quickly it can execute. It's more of what can the browser do in terms of the document object model, moving things around, how fast can it render the changes?
How fast can it draw to the canvas, especially three-dimensional objects?
Right. So if you're doing
a little bit of marketing is kind of what your first suggestion was, that it's not something you have to worry about that much. Are these other browsers going to support DirectX, or are they going to always stay with OpenGL?
Are they going to support DirectX
or WebGL?
If they're on Windows, probably they are all going to have accelerated stuff accelerated by the GPU eventually. It's And they already have some stuff that is done by, when you're using platform calls, a lot of that stuff is shared with DirectX.
Like, right.
You're going to have acceleration regardless of whether it works in the canvas or not.
Well, thank you. I think we've covered this one a bit. Al from Watsonville, thank you so much for the call.
Do I have time for a quick follow-up?
Sure.
Is HTML5 necessary to tie this all together?
Yes.
It is. Okay.
Well, to deal with the canvas tag correctly.
Yes. Okay, yes.
Fair enough. That's a short answer. Thank you, Al. And one of Al's neighbors, Annan, also called in and said, I think it would be an ant whisperer. So that's good to know. Victoria, British Columbia. Greg, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, everybody. Just wanted to do a follow-up question, if I could, on last week's Apple TV. How is it for streaming from your other computers in the house?
It's extremely good. I think we talked about Apple TV last week with Al. He got one and was really enjoying it. Yes, streaming from your local network, it's great. I think it's kind of a matched pair with one machine, but you can actually, I'm not sure about that. Like, if you've got multiple machines, I'm not sure how well it does that way. But from one machine, definitely it's real clean. I've seen it.
So you're having to import stuff into your iTunes library?
It's an iTunes library handshaking thing. But then again, okay. It might do more than that. Unfortunately, the guy that has one's not here this week.
Yeah,
he'll be here next week. Yeah. And Al would definitely know how to answer that. We're pretty good about answering questions on the Geeks mailing list. So if you go up to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, ask us a question, assuming that it's something that, like, this one Al would answer, right? Because it's something he knows and he wouldn't be lost on it. So he'd probably answer you pretty quick.
All right.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks.
Bye. All right, back to the Santa Cruz area. Jana, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Jana,
so sorry. Hi.
I'm wondering if you know of an alternative to Netflix. I would like to stream movies on the Internet, and I'm wondering if there's any services other than Netflix.
For movies?
Yes.
Streaming.
Yes.
You know, I know there are. I don't know any of them.
Okay.
On the top of my head. Lindsay, you know of any streaming?
I'm trying to look things up, but I use Netflix off the top of my, so I don't know anything off the top
right,
of my head.
Right.
I've been satisfied with the service, so.
Blockbuster's not available.
Yeah, in terms of a $20 a month job, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that has the same reach that Netflix does. I know that things like iTunes and Amazon, Vudu is another one. They all have a service where it's a pay-as-you-go. So you pay 99 cents and you're able to get a particular movie. So if you're...
Oh, okay.
Or I don't know if it's 99 cents.
It
may be close to like $3.
Apple does this too with the iTunes.
Yeah, so anywhere between $1 and $3, I think, is standard. So depending on how much you watch,
right.
Then it may be useful. In general, I think Amazon has more things digitized than Netflix.
I agree.
But then you have to pay... per item, so
okay.
Why not Netflix?
Well, I don't like their advertising. It's gotten kind of annoying, so.
So you want to punish them for that? I think that's good. I think consumers should take more responsibility for, you know, taking things that you're getting services they like from companies they like rather than just getting what's available. So I think that's
which advertising? I'm curious.
I get a pop-up window from Netflix, and I've tried to block pop-up windows on my computer. So, and they're the only ones that
when does it show up?
What's that?
Oh, just random web browsing?
Yeah. When I'm just looking at other things, the Netflix pop-up window happens.
I'd be really curious. Netflix has an amazing customer service from what I've heard. And I like the CEO whenever he speaks and stuff. I'd be curious what would happen if you called in with complaint.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Let's see what they say. See, you know, I want to get a service like yours, but I really don't like your advertising. It's annoying me.
Yeah.
How do we handle this problem?
Okay.
I'm curious what would happen.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe I'll
try
that.
Assuming you've got some time. Because it might take some time. Thank you so much for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's do one news story because I really want to get this story about the FBI. Miles, do you mind covering a little bit about that?
Sure. The FBI we covered a story. Sorry, to give some background. We covered a story where a court case said that it was all right to put a GPS tracker on someone's car, even if the car was in their private driveway.
Right, I remember you talking about this story.
And track them without getting a warrant. Well, it turns out a California student did get a visit from the FBI after he found that tracking device on his car and was like, what the? This is, huh? and started posting about it and, you know, wondered whether or not it was because he was Arab American, you know, was of Arab descent. And so he started asking, like, what's this about? And within 2 days, the FBI goes, yeah, we were watching you. Can we have our GPS device back? It's expensive. Or something to that effect. And he's like, well, wait a second here. Like, you put it on my car. Isn't it mine now? Yeah. And he's like, what is this? People are, like, watching me and not...
Yeah.
Just this... Someone randomly puts a GPS device. The FBI's response was, oh, don't worry. We found you're really not interesting. Which really flies in the face of this... You shouldn't be worried if you have nothing to hide.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they didn't know he was interesting until he just went to the grocery store and worked.
Right. But he's not an immigrant. He's a 20-year-old U.S.-born U.S. citizen.
So wait, how many systems are out there if they're like, what, you have one? Oh, you're not interesting. Oh, I don't know how they got in your car.
Well, no, they put it on them and started watching where he went and then decided, yeah, this doesn't fit the pattern.
Oh, man. And of course, for a reminder of this story, it's really that agents can put GPS units on people's cars if the car is in the driveway, because that's relatively a public space and you shouldn't expect privacy there. And so therefore, they don't need a warrant or anything. They can just do it if it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I am curious about is whether he legally has to give it back.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I drop something off, like if I... put something in a package and leave it on your doorstep. Do I have a legal right to be able to say, hey, I want that back now?
Well, no, but you leave it on the doorstep. That's, I mean, yeah, exactly. That's not stolen property. That was given to him. That was put on his property for whatever purpose.
I'm really curious. I'm going to watch the story and to see whether or not there's actually a...
Man, I wanted to put one on my car. I want to see what these things look like.
There is a picture, and I'll put this up on the website for someone to look at. It's basically this long device with a transmitter.
Remember when we had the Ackerman police officer from San Jose on the mm-hmm. show a few years ago? And we were talking about the systems that they have in San Jose where the police are taking pictures of every license plate, like all the
going
cars.
Through a parking lot, yeah.
Yeah, going through parking lots and just seeing, getting pictures and collecting where the, and getting... text to or optics to text translations, so that basically any car that the police officer's camera sees, you date where it was and when it was, all that. And it was kind of creepy to us. You know, we both were kind of, I remember both kind of just inhaled.
Yeah, I'm actually backpedaling on that.
It's the same kind of story of it's public space, so there's no privacy there. It's, mm-hmm. what's wrong with it? And I made the analogy, like, if you had a beat cop who walked around four blocks and that was his job in New York, if a new car's in the neighborhood, he's going to know just because he's going to recognize all the cars. And so what's wrong with that? Like, that's a good thing. Maybe if you put a notepad and took down certain, but this kind of thing where at that time I just felt a little creepy, this is more creepy. And one of the things that it brings up is, wait, who has access to this data? Is it just anybody, any police officer? Is any FBI agent have a few of these things in his car and he can slap one on somebody he doesn't like and wants to see what's going on? I mean, where is the line? When you have a judge involved, you have a really clear process and policy.
Right.
When you don't, it's unknown. So if I'm a police officer in San Jose, can I find out where grandma was last week by looking?
And this case brings up a very interesting wrinkle to it, which is there is a different standard for people who live in a gated community or... live in a large enough place where they have like a gate at the front. So
Somebody that has a garage, for example, won't get their car tagged.
Right. Has a very, like, how wealthy are you?
Right.
Aspect to it. You know, you don't have enough to live in a gated community. Well, I guess you get tagged. Oh, you are rich enough that you have this.
So there's also, the thing is with that, of course, if you live in a gated community, you're going to take your car out sometimes and park it in a garage. So if you're followed, and then they put a tracking system on you, it's not that hard. You know what I'm saying? But I get what you're saying, that it is definitely a person that lives in a lower income space has no place but a public street to put their car. Very cool. And thanks for the story. I appreciate that. Lindsay, you want to do one before we wrap it up for the day? How about R2-D2? I love droids. So.
Yeah. Well, I wasted a bunch of time on this. It's kind of like a scavenger hunt. Droid, Android R2-D2 phone. So the Droid 2 phone, but with Motorola, and yeah, it's a neat phone, and I've been thinking about getting one as my next phone, but I've been just waiting for 2.2 operating system to come out for you.
It's always easy to wait, huh?
Yes, and they came out with this, basically it is a scavenger hunt, an internet scavenger hunt, where you could sign up and they would send you emails and you would, it was a marketing thing. They wanted you to sign up for their Twitter sites and go view the websites, and you could win a free Droid R2-D2 model phone. And of course, Star Wars theme, it has a base that looks like carbonite, and the phone itself looks like R2-D2, and it comes with a package of software, you know, makes the noises, the tweets and things like that. So I decided I wanted to try and win this phone. And they lead you around all over the place looking for clues that are like viewing site or viewing the source on websites and different things like that.
Geeky stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty geeky. It was fun.
How'd you do?
I didn't win a phone. Yeah, but I thought it was going to be a collector's item, but it turns out they're selling them now.
Oh, so you can buy one?
You can buy one for $50 more than what you would pay for a regular Droid 2. So I was like, oh man, all
that
time I wasted.
If you walk in with one of those phones, you'll be definitely worshipped for at least a week.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then it's worth it. Yeah, for $50 bucks. Get some worship.
Geek worship's worth it, huh?
Yeah, the geek cred. The geek cred for that. So great. Yeah, but the website, I think, is still up, and the website is designed really neat. They
and
do
it's a fun game to do.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. All right, cool. Frustrating, and all the hours that I spent, it was worth way more than $50.
Scavenger hunt's awesome.
Once I found out they were selling them, I was like, dang it. I just bought one. And they did a big release across.
I got to say, they did a good job, because you just mentioned on air to thousands and thousands of people. So they clearly did their marketing scheme well.
Yeah, they did.
Got you.
They totally got me.
And it's also got really good cryptography and such on the phone, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely a geeky phone.
And they did a big release across the country where people dressed up as Star Wars characters and went to the Verizon stores and
got
stuff
a Droid.
Like that.
Oh, my gosh.
It's funny.
Well, thank you very much for that. Miles, we do have time really quick for some BBC information and updates.
Well, the news that I was going to cover on that is very quick. It's the BBC has altered their link guidelines for their online articles. This I'm getting this from The Guardian, actually, but the BBC has this up on their website as well. That anytime they talk about science, they are going to link to the actual journal article rather than just the journal homepage.
Which BBC is?
Yes.
Nice.
And which is a nice trend, and I hope more organizations do the same thing. Yeah. And it actually prompted me to think of, well, with GeekSpeak, we don't always do that, and we probably should take more effort to do
find
that as
the
well.
Source. Yeah. We're normally just grabbing the story that we heard it from. I agree. I think we should have more links to the actual journal entries and the actual studies, even though they are sometimes hard to read. And sometimes, of course, the studies are not free in public, right? They're kind of hidden behind stuff. So it's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Probably a little – yeah. Anyway, so I normally endeavor when I'm doing news stories and stuff to try to find the closest source possible rather than just quoting an article. Because unless the story is about media, and that's actually what you're talking about, is the article. All right, thank you very much, Miles. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to business tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. The Geeks today were Lindsay Lonnie. Thank you, Lindsay, for being here and doing news.
My pleasure.
It's been a while. We need to have you here more often.
I'm up for it.
All right. And Mr. Miles Elam, who's here almost all the time, and will be actually doing the show for the next 2 weeks while I'm off. Thank you, Miles, for being here.
Yes, always.
My name is Lyle Troxell. Answering the phones is Rick Philman, as he is almost every single week. And we thank you very much, Rick. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence. And David Lawrence is the puppet master on Heroes. So thank you, puppet master. Was? Is he dead finally?
No, Heroes was canceled.
Heroes canceled? Oh, I didn't know that. I don't watch TV. Sorry. Radio, baby. That's what it's about. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. Coming up next is Car Talk. Thanks for listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell.